From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we're going to look at two congressional districts, traditionally Republican, going through political change. Western Michigan voters have a lot to think about from the top of the ticket on down. Also, more than two dozen counties have now affirmed gun rights. Gun owners feel strongly about them, but what do these declarations change?
The point I think that's important is that these are resolutions and they do not have the power of law.
And a conversation with Saladin Ahmed, a poet and prose writer. He's made a stellar transition to comic books. We'll speak with him about the morality of modern mythology.
I work a lot to redefine who the heroes and villains are, right? That they might not follow the patterns we've been told so far in these genres.
He's writing some of Marvel's most exciting young characters. All that's coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Well, today we got the announcement from Congressman Fred Upton. He's announced that he will indeed seek re-election to continue to represent his Southwest Michigan district. Upton has been in office for the 6th district for more than 30 years. It's not so much the announcement that was surprising as how narrowly he maintained control of the seat during the Democratic wave of the 2018 midterm elections. Does Fred Upton face another tough challenge this year? Can Republicans expect to hold on to Michigan's 6th? Here to break it down for us is longtime Republican operative John Selleck, CEO of Harbor Strategic Public Relations. Say, John.
Good afternoon, April.
So Fred Upton got a pretty serious challenge from Democrat Matt Longjohn in 2018. He only held on by, I want to say, a single digit. Does Fred Upton have anything to worry about, or do you see 2018 as more of a fluke?
I don't think he has anything to worry about, but what it does do for him, like it would do for a lot of people who'd been in office for a long time and had won by comfortable margins, every once in a while, like in life, we get a wake-up call. And it reminds us that even though we're doing a good job in Washington, it's hard to have a foot way over in Washington and a foot way over in Michigan, and you get back here and you work your tail off. And I've had people ask me today, is it a surprise that he's running for re-election? I'd say no, but was there suspense? Yes. Fred Upton is one of the last, basically, of a long line or a long generation of Michigan congressional members that held a lot of seniority in Washington, even as Michigan is losing seats. You know, we've lost over the last few years, Sandy Levin, Dave Camp, John Dingell, Mike Rogers, Candace Miller. Fred is really kind of the last man standing on that front, but it would appear he's energized and ready to go.
Fred Upton has always been amenable to working across the aisle. Generally, he votes as a center-right Republican. What is it that makes Southwest Michigan a unique congressional district where he's been able to provide a good fit for constituents?
But you really have to break it apart by county. And there is one county in that district that has moved away from Republicans pretty rapidly over the last few years. It's Kalamazoo County. It's a college county with Western Michigan University there, and it's a place unlike some of the other I-94 corridor communities like Battle Creek right next door where President Trump actually appeared at a rally in December. Kalamazoo has moved away in the state legislature as an example. But that's the driving force there inside that district and what could make it more of a challenge in 2020. You know, Upton in particular he's been careful to call out Trump when he needs to. When Trump said something bad about John Dingell, Upton called for him to apologize. When Trump said something about the squad needing to go back to where they came from, Upton came out and said he was wrong to say that. So he's not a sitting right-wing target like a lot of the Democrats would want to paint him.
So meanwhile, just to the north, Justin Amash is now running as an independent. Folks will remember he left the Republican Party and lost some pretty critical support from the DeVos family. Amash is a rare bird in Washington, D.C. He's one of the most ideologically consistent voices and also a libertarian. How do you think he's going to play with constituents at the ballot box this year? I mean, this is another guy from Western Michigan. Do you think he'll be rewarded for the time that he spent going up against the president?
Well, I think what people have appreciated on that side of the state, that's a state where they don't really like show horses. They like work horses. The culture there, mentality is hardworking, go to church on Sunday, you know, mind your P's and Q's. He kind of stood out from that pack a little bit because he made most of his time in Congress about his ideological purity, like you mentioned earlier, and less about you know, what things was he accomplishing or getting done to bring home to West Michigan, like congressmen typically are focused on. I think the folks there, because they saw him as an honest broker on what he was talking about, he was earnest about what he was talking about, they kind of gave him a pass for a long time instead of talking about some of the more nitty-gritty issues in the district. I'm not so sure that'll be the case this time. What we have to look at is a long track record of folks voting Republican, voting straight ticket.
John, we have just a few seconds left. Put together, these two districts would seem to be telling us Western Michigan is changing. What do we take away from that?
Where there are big urban centers, people are self-separating. Big urban centers are becoming very, very blue, and more rural areas are becoming more and more red. So in the 3rd Congressional District, it's Grand Rapids that has suddenly, you know, from when I was young in politics, it was a very conservative place, and nowadays it's a center for hipsters. And then, like I mentioned earlier, Kalamazoo, another college town, big urban place that is becoming more and more blue. And so those are kind of like anchors around the Republicans who run in those seats. I think they can overcome them, but they certainly have become the focus of Democrat attention.
John Selleck is the CEO of Harbor Strategic Public Relations. John, good talking to you.
Great talking to you too, April. Have a good one.
You too. Last night, Livingston County became the 27th in Michigan to pass a resolution supporting gun rights. It's not legally binding, but it affirms the county's right to sovereignty above state or federal lawmaking with respect to guns. Mike Detmer, a Republican primary candidate for Michigan's 8th Congressional District and a resident of Howell, told Michigan Radio it's a symbolic victory.
The point of this is the voice of the people. So for our state legislators and our governor to understand that as more and more counties come online as sanctuary counties, we're going to push back towards any infringements on our Second Amendment.
As you've heard in previous weeks on our show, supporters of these resolutions often say that they're responding to proposals they've seen in other states like Virginia. There are those in Michigan who feel it would be appropriate for the state to take some action on gun regulation. Linda Brundage is the executive director of the Michigan Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence, and she joins me now. Welcome to the show, Linda.
Thank you for having me.
So the number of counties passing resolutions making a statement on gun rights interpretation is now up to 27. Does that surprise you?
Well, it's concerning to me, the speed of which this is happening. I think it's all pretty much happened since mid-January. And it doesn't seem that allows for much deliberation on a very important issue.
As this issue has come up in other states and been tested, it's very rare that sheriffs or local police would have occasion to go in direct conflict with state or federal laws with respect to gun control. But it's very clear that the people passing these resolutions want to see more pushback and more challenges. Would you expect to see any sort of test of these resolutions in Michigan?
Well, the point I think that's important is that these are resolutions and they do not have the power of law. So they are really, in a sense, a political statement. And the coalition is very concerned about these kinds of resolutions. In Michigan, we don't even have the types of legislation that is driving these, I'm going to call them illegal nullification resolutions in other states. They've been primarily coming to the fore secondary to what is called the red flag law or extreme risk protection orders. And Michigan doesn't even have that type of legislation, unfortunately. It's been proposed in both the House and the Senate, and of course it's languishing in judiciary. Extreme risk protection laws save lives. There's just no question about it. Connecticut has this type of legislation for approximately 17 years, so it's very well researched to support the fact that it saves lives.
Regardless of whether the resolutions that some of the counties have passed will change the way that sheriffs or police officers carry out the law, It seems like these resolutions really indicate a feeling of insecurity among some gun owners about what may lie ahead for them. What does it mean to work for sensible gun laws when there are so many people who find gun laws unacceptable in this way?
Well, for one thing, I'm not sure how many people are really behind these. I think it's a very vocal group. You know, there are a couple of key players in Michigan that are involved in many of the county resolutions. So to say it's a great number of people, I simply don't know that that's the case. They're very vocal, and they've organized very quickly. However, in places like Antrim County, people who are for gun safety and for gun sense also organized, and they were able to speak to their commissioners, and the resolution there was voted down. So I think it's unfortunate that people are not understanding what the gun sense legislation is. Background checks, universal background checks, so that every gun purchased and sold would have a background check. Pretty simple. The extreme risk protection order. If there's a person who is dangerous to self or others, a judge determines that they should not have guns in their possession, those guns are removed. There is due process to the potentially dangerous person. It's a civil matter, and they can have their guns returned. So, you know, those are two of the kinds of legislation that the Michigan Coalition is working for. A third is safe storage, which is child access prevention legislation. No child should ever have a gun. They should not have access to it. If a gun's not actively being used, it should be locked up. And we believe that most people agree with those common sense pieces of legislation. We know that there are many gun owners who say, oh, background check, sure, no problem. Oh, extreme risk protection order, of course, let's prevent deaths, let's prevent suicides. And we believe that responsible gun owners see it that way as well.
Linda Brundage, thanks so much for your time on this.
You're welcome. Thank you for calling.
Linda Brundage is the executive director of the Michigan Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence. If you'd like to hear earlier stories that we've done on gun resolutions in Michigan's counties, just head to our website. Coming up, more revelations from the Detroit News' investigation into a deceased U of M doctor accused of sexual harassment. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. The Detroit News has been reporting unfolding allegations against Dr. Robert E. Anderson, a prominent figure in the University of Michigan's athletics department and former director of University Health Service. He died in 2008. Several alumni have come forward claiming Anderson sexually assaulted them during inappropriate exams. Subsequent stories by lead reporter Kim Kozlowski revealed Anderson had been fired from a high-ranking administrative job only to continue as a practicing physician for the U of M's wrestlers and football players. Kozlowski and other Detroit News staff have continued to pursue the story, and their latest article details how university investigator Mark West kept at Washtenaw County prosecutors for 9 months trying to get more attention for the case. George Hunter is a reporter who has been working on part of the story. He joins us now. George, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
The story you published reports that a University of Michigan investigator was trying to get the Washtenaw County prosecutor to look more deeply into the claims against Dr. Anderson. Can you tell us a little more about the back and forth between the investigator and the prosecutor?
Well, apparently they dropped this off in April. They dropped off a report on this doctor, and then they immediately told them, hey, don't send this through the computer system where you usually would send those things. You know, there's a system they have set up, and they wanted it attached as an email. It was called OnBase, and their reason for saying that is that they never expected this to actually get prosecuted because the doctor died, I think it was in 2002, and the statute of limitations had expired. So they said, don't put it into this system. Some people are saying that's suspicious, you know, but they had an answer to that. So they drop it off in April, this report detailing years of alleged sexual abuse by this guy, who, if you remember, he had been moved out of a position in 1979. And it's unclear whether or not he got moved because of the sexual abuse, but that seems to be the implication here, because a university employee expressed shock to the police officer that he was allowed to continue. But he was, after apparently they found a bunch of that he was abusing these young men sexually, he was allowed to stay on for 20-something years after that.
Right.
So anyway, this U of M cop, Detective West, he asked him over a period of 9 months, you know, hey, have you done anything with this report? Have you even had a time to review it? And the assistant prosecutor, Siller, answers back, no, he never got to it. At one point, he says, no, too many murders. I guess they had a spike of murders.
Let me just ask, in Washtenaw County, he's saying there's been too many murders.
Yeah, that kind of piqued my interest, too. I mean, everything's relative. I do most of my work in Wayne County. I can guarantee you whatever they consider a spike out there, it would be a slow day in Wayne County. So but I don't know if they have the manpower set up to deal with that. But I didn't notice any great spike in murders, a cursory look. Now, mind you, I didn't do a deep dive into it.
Right.
But I did a cursory look. It didn't look like there was this great spike in murders. And when I asked him about that, I don't know if this part made the story, but he basically said, well, there were a lot that were open. It did not that they necessarily happened during that time. But the upshot is this detective from U of M kept following up and saying, what's going on? Have you looked at this report? And 9 months later, he still hadn't even looked at it. So one of the alleged victims accused him of slow walking it, basically.
So the university investigator did react to the slow pace of movement in the prosecutor's office?
There's no reaction that I saw per se other than saying, hey, you know, have you looked at this yet? And then when I asked the spokeswoman about this, she kind of said, you know, hey, we did follow up. We did send this over and we've kept following up on it. So she wanted to make that point clear that it wasn't like they threw it, you know, onto the desk and let it gather dust. They were following up and apparently they discussed it at a U of M football game. That was one of the things that the prosecutor told us, that, you know, yeah, there was no email about it, but they talked about it at a football game.
So how have both the investigator and the prosecutor reacted to this case breaking open?
Again, I've not seen much reaction. I think the prosecutor's been talking. They sent us an email yesterday with their answers. But certainly one of the alleged victims, he's the one that says he broke this whole thing open. He says that the doctor molested him in 1971, and this was so bad, I guess they called him Dr. Drop Your Drawers. That was the nickname that a lot of the students had for him because he was kind of known for this. It almost sounds like the exact same thing that happened with Larry Nassar, where there were whispers about this, and it's certainly alleged that the university didn't do anything about it. So it looks like we have another one of these cases.
Yeah. George, the prosecutor, again, his reason for saying that he didn't think this should be forwarded through the electronic system is, according to him, that number one, Dr. Anderson is dead. Number two, the statute of limitations had passed on at least some of the allegations. I mean, from a prosecutor's standpoint, is there some precedent for that point of view, or did you get any sense that they're trying to argue that maybe there was another channel to deal with it, not in the electronic system?
I didn't get that sense at all. It just seemed like they weren't asked to prosecute the case. He made kind of put a fine line around that point. He says they weren't asked to prosecute anything. They were just being asked to review this. You know, that'd be my first follow-up question. Why send it to a prosecutor if you didn't expect it to be prosecuted? And
yeah,
is that even the case? I mean, from the cops, did the cops expect that it would be prosecuted somehow? Or I think they were looking into it, according to the prosecutor, Hiller, that, you know, to see if there was any prosecution. But that doesn't seem to answer why not just run it through the normal computer system like you would all the other allegations.
George, we've seen some stories such as Michigan State, Penn State, and Ohio State that involve not just criminal behavior, but a problematic pattern of protecting the accused. Do you see potential for this story to get bigger as a result of you know, some of what we've seen in these emails?
It could. There's an allegation in one of these documents, and we got a trove of stuff here. One of the allegations is that there were dozens of these, you know, and we say in the journalism business, you know, it's the old, it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. you know, from my vantage point, it does seem like there's an effort to cover this stuff up. Boy, it sure seems like there's at universities, plural, I don't want to pick on just one, that they want to protect their brand at all costs. That seems to be the prevailing attitude.
George Hunter of the Detroit News, he and his colleague Kim Koslowski have been investigating the University of Michigan's Dr. Robert E. Anderson and some of the sexual abuse allegations connected with his record at the U of M. George, thanks for your time.
I appreciate it. Take care now.
The Michigan primary is now just 2 weeks away, March 10th. Back in 2016, Bernie Sanders pulled off a surprising upset in Michigan's primary election, beating out rival Hillary Clinton. Well, it's 2020, and Bernie Sanders, after doing well in Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada, is facing a much more crowded field of Democratic candidates. So, will Sanders still be Michigan's pick to run against President Donald Trump? And should he be? We'd love to get your thoughts. We'll be doing some reporting on this in the weeks to come. Leave us a voicemail by calling 734-764-7840. That's 734-764-7840. If writer Saladin Ahmed never typed another word, he'd already have introduced us to so many interesting people. Right now, he's the author on two major titles for Marvel Comics, The Magnificent Ms. Marvel and Miles Morales, Spider-Man. If it's been a while since you've caught up, Peter Parker has handed the mantle over to Miles, who's a biracial teenager living in Brooklyn.
How could there be two Spider-Men? There can't be two Spider-Men. Can there?
That's from Into the Spider-Verse, a recent film featuring Miles Morales. Saladin Ahmed took over the comic book version of the character from creator Brian Bendis and is putting his own stamp on the story. He's also cranking out all manner of surprising and wonderful prose. Let's take a listen to him reading from one of his short stories, Mr. Hodges' Sunset Ride. This will give you a sense of his style.
I've ridden with good men and bad men, but I've never ridden with a man like Mr. Hodge. That wasn't his proper name, just a way of calling the old man respectful-like. My pa taught me that, if I ever met a man from the old country, to call him Hodge. Damn near the only thing that son of a bitch ever taught me. Anyhow, a good few years back now, when I was a young, full-of-himself bounty hunter, I fell in with Mr. Hodge in the Black Hills. We rode together for about a year. He was a little leather-brown knot of a man with a moonlight white beard, and he took an immediate and powerful shine to me on account of my pa's being from Araby. Now, understand I'm a bastard. I carry my mama's name, O'Connor. But the way I look, a little bit darker than the average man I know, and you can see the hatchet nose, well, I get taken for a lot of things. South of the border, I've fibbed that I was half Mexican. Lived a summer trading with the Cheyenne, claiming to be part red man. Even got chased out of town once when I winked at the wrong girl because they were sure as could be that I was a mulatto. It can be hell sometimes being different things to different folks, but it can be right useful too. Well, Mr. Hodge must have smelled the old country in my blood somehow. Like I say, he took a shine to me, and my knowing how to call him respectfully seemed to seal it for him. I can't say I ever understood it, but Mr. Hodge was the kind of man you wanted on your side, so I wasn't about to complain. For what it's worth, I was the last man ever saw him alive.
Saladin Ahmed reading from his short story, Mr. Hodge's Sunset Ride. Saladin Ahmed keeps mastering different gears, whether it's westerns, sword and sorcery, or supernatural sleuthing. We invited him in to talk about recent work. Saladin Ahmed, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
You got into writing for poetry. I feel like that's kind of akin to exploring an interest in architecture and the trades by building a house. I mean, it's not an easy form to master. What did working in an economical format like poetry do for your writing?
It's just that. It definitely taught me economy. It taught me that you can say a lot with a few words, that you can evoke a lot of feeling in people
with a few words if they're carefully chosen. And so I really have brought that to everything that I've written, whether it's prose or comics or dabbling in TV, whatever it might be. I try and bring that energy from poetry.
There may be some people listening to this who heard you read around Detroit or other spots on the spoken word scene. But for those who didn't, what are your poems like?
Oh, gosh. I'm not much of an active poet these days, so mostly they're sort of a portrait of me as a younger writer. But they were always sort of, even though they were different forms, they were concerned with a lot of the same things I've stayed concerned with. They've been about justice, about people, working people, about different kinds of people's stories, and also been about genre. You know, I was putting werewolves and Valkyries and things like that into poetry, even when I was supposed to be writing a very abstract poetry for my MFA years ago. I was always sort of filtering in comic book and fantasy elements into there. So I think the subjects stay the same, even as the form changes for me.
So attentive readers could have seen all this coming, really.
Maybe, if people actually read poetry. more than 17 people actually read those poems, yes.
Well, you got into comics writing something that was maybe only slightly less ambitious. You were recruited to do a run of Marvel's Black Bolt. He's a little bit less well-known than Iron Man or Captain Marvel, so I think I better lay it out. He's the king of the Inhumans, a super team, and really an entire class of people who populate the Marvel universe. And he's almost ridiculously powerful, capable of, you know, breaking down a building with his voice, and super strong. And you basically put him in an interstellar prison and had him figure his way out of the situation, while at the same time coming into contact with some well-known figures from the Marvel universe. What was it like coming in on a character that beloved to hardcore fans of comic books?
Yeah, it was an interesting challenge of a book because it was meant to both sort of introduce a character who's sort of not necessarily known to everybody who knows who Spider-Man or Wolverine is, but also meant to sort of be a reach out to hardcore fans who have this established relationship. Black Bolt was created by Jack Kirby, you know, gosh, all these, you know, 50 years ago, something. So, you know, there are people who've been following him for decades. And it's like most of my work with Marvel, it was this sort of balance between bringing a new voice to the character and sort of honoring the legacy.
You came up in the 1980s at a time when the X-Men and Secret Wars were kind of the big events in the Marvel universe. It's very heavy psychological stuff and very heavy on character interactions, although obviously with tons of the, you know, the big fight sequences that we go to comics mm-hmm. for. What were the writers who were doing those stories doing that hooked you?
You know, it's been fascinating for me coming to the industry as an adult, because 30 years ago when I was reading those stories, 35 years ago I was reading those stories, I didn't know who the writers were. I just knew the characters, right? As was the case, I think, for most comic book fans for most of comic book history. And so it's only as an adult that I've come to realize that writers like Chris Claremont, Ann Nesenti, Tony Isabella, all these people who are telling these very human stories and very not just human in some broad universal sense, but very rooted human stories that were about characters with actual ethnic and class histories and professions that they came from and things like that that affected who they were. And really, it was about real people like that kind of trying to contend with absurd galactic scale conspiracies and powers and things like that. And that synthesis, which to me has always been a kind of hallmark of Marvel, but in the 80s got a certain kind of real hardcore focus from some of those writers. It taught me a lot about becoming a writer.
It feels like also it was a place for those of us who didn't really like soap operas to indulge in some of the pleasures of soap operas, the ongoing storylines and the cliffhangers and and all of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you had told me as a you know 10-year-old boy that I loved soap operatics, I would have had a very stupid gendered reaction and twisted up my face. But absolutely, I've tried to hook into that as a writer too. Dynamics are to me what comic books are about as much as anything. What happens between characters, and that's emotional as much as it is who can beat who in a fight.
Comics are, at the end of the day, basically a form of serialized fiction. Mm-hmm. How have you adapted your writing to that kind of story?
Well, it's a very different form with very different demands. And to some degree, I sort of had to learn that. I was lucky in having Black Bolt as my first character because I got to sort of narrate a lot of his thoughts since he can't speak. And so it was a sort of transition from prose for me. And I worked with an artist, Christian Ward, and an editor, Will Moss, who were all very helpful in kind of teaching me to step back when the pictures could tell the story, right? And to trust the reader a bit more in a way that in prose you sort of handhold a bit. You have to do all the evocation through words, right? Of sight, of sound, of everything. You're working as part of a collaborative team when you do that in comics, and it's been liberating for me actually to get to do that. It's made me very productive as a writer, and so clearly there's something in me that clicked.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Saladin Ahmed. Coming up, we'll hear about his work on Miles Morales, Spider-Man, and the magnificent Ms. Marvel. Also a new superhero he's introducing to the Marvel pantheon straight out of his hometown of Dearborn.
It was very important for me to show an Arab man and a Muslim man or young man who was kind.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're going to continue my conversation with writer Saladin Ahmed. His work spans form and genre. His fantasy novel, Throne of the Crescent Moon, was nominated for a Hugo Award in 2013. And he's also a writer right now for several Marvel Comics series. We're going to pick up our conversation with what is probably the best-known character Saladin has written so far. You took over writing Miles Morales, the guy that Brian Bendis created to sort of move Spider-Man's legacy forward. He's the character that people might have seen in Into the Spider-Verse, the animated film from 2 years ago. And he's a young kid. He lives in Brooklyn, and he's a very different guy than Peter Parker, who was the original Spider-Man. Miles Morales is maybe not as much of a wise guy, maybe a little bit more vulnerable, and still figuring out his heroicism and like how it works to be a superhero. What have you enjoyed about writing him?
Oh, Miles has just been an absolute blast to write. And when Marvel came to me, I was it was just such an enthusiastic yes. It's because he does embody a lot of Peter and a lot of what I loved about Peter as a kid, this sort of confused teenage superhero trying to balance everything at once and sort of constantly having stuff thrown at him. He's a working class kid from Outer Borough, New York, and I think that's all continuity with Peter rather than difference from him. But I do think Miles has his differences. He's kind of cooler than Peter. He might be more emotionally vulnerable, less of a wise cracker in some sense. But I think even as the sort of converse of that, he's a little hipper than Peter was.
Yeah.
And that's fun to write. The first couple arcs of the book were drawn by Javier Garon, who is excellent at drawing clothes, and that's so important in a teenager's world, right?
I did not even think of that, but that's really true.
The haircuts, all of that stuff matters, and readers have really responded to Miles kind of representing the next generation with that stuff. But probably the primary thing, the center for Miles that is maybe a little lacking in Peter's life is family. He has two stable parents at home. Who've just become parents to his little sister.
Baby
in the
sister
comic,
now, too.
Actually.
Yeah.
They both know that he's Spider-Man. They're both sort of worried but supportive. And he has an uncle who's a sort of on-again, off-again supervillain or anti-hero type. And so he's got a network around him of family, of community, that was always absent with Peter, who always felt very like a very lonely character to me.
You know, if there's a thread through your stories that you've written, both in prose form and for comic books, it feels like a strong sense that good guys need to win, even if stories are not always, strictly speaking, happy endings. And I just can't help but thinking, given the dark turn that so many comics titles have taken in recent years, I just think that your worldview is kind of an interesting choice for some heroes. Do you feel like it's an easy fit for you?
Huh. That's an interesting point. I guess it is pretty important to me to I work a lot to redefine who the heroes and villains are, right? That they might not follow the patterns we've been told so far in these genres. But at the end of the day, I think there are some good guys and bad guys. And I think it's important to show models where good guys can win through working together, through self-sacrifice, through community, through sort of embracing empathy rather than greed. I think it's crucial right now to show that that can lead to victories, even if sometimes, you know, this is mythology stuff, right? That's what our comic book stories, our fantasy stories are right now. These are the mythology of our modern day. And for me, those myths should show heroes. They should show heroes triumphing in a way that can inspire us, even when that victory is not always entirely possible in real life. It gives us something to strive for.
Is that something that occupies much of your thought about the real world too?
You know, I've got kids, so you have to have some. I'm a very dark, cynical person by nature, and so if I indulge that, you know, it's very easy, just based on my own experiences as an Arab Muslim man in America for 40 something years, it's very easy to see darkness ahead, and maybe that's realistic, but. But what are we going to do? Stop going, you know? And we can't keep going if all we see is that darkness. And so I try and think about what skin of their teeth escape, comic book level escape, might be possible for my kids in this future. And you know, you just you tell yourself those stories and try and work toward them, even if they're not super realistic all the time.
Right. Another one of the titles that you're working on right now is The Magnificent Ms. Marvel. And again, we need to play a little catch-up for folks who may not be dropping by their comic book store every week. Ms. Marvel is no longer the blonde bombshell Carol Danvers, who has gone on and moved her sparkly fists over to become Captain Marvel. Ms. Marvel, as she is read today, is Kamala Khan, Jersey City's Muslim-American teenage superhero who is able to change her body's shape, embiggening into whatever situation she needs to fill. And another one of Marvel's younger characters who's sort of finding her way into a world of heroes. This was another title that has just come to mean so much to people, both in terms of representation and just in terms of storytelling power in the last couple of years. Is she easy for you to write?
No, she's she's deeply difficult for me to write. I mean, if I think about what's been my biggest challenge writing, it's been Kamala, which is odd. You know, people are sort of, when I started to talk about working at Marvel, everyone's like, oh, you've got to write, you know, because there are
well,
so
because
few
she's Arab American?
Muslim. Well, she's Pakistani.
Oh, sorry.
But
yeah.
Because she's Muslim American. And so, you know, of course, you've got to do this. And naturally enough, when Willow, the co-creator of the character,
Willow Wilson, yeah.
Willow Wilson went on to write Wonder Woman in DC, you know, she wanted to hand this character off. She and Sana Ananat, who had at Marvel, who had co-created this character, they wanted to hand this character off to somebody who understood some things about her, for lack of a more subtle way to put it, right? And I was deeply intimidated at the prospect of taking over the comic, and yet I had all sorts of ideas about where the character might go, and so there's been a bit of a learning curve. Even though we've got lots in common, I think in a strange way, I have more in common with Miles I think we're conditioned so much along the lines of gender. And mm-hmm. Especially when I was a young man, we were. And that getting into a teenage girl's head has proven a challenge. And I know that I've dropped the ball at times, but I've sort of found a groove on that book that I feel very comfortable in. And it's meant a lot to me to get it right because she is so important to so many people. When I go to conventions, both with her and with Miles, there are so many young fans out there or older fans who never got to see those characters when they were older or who are getting to see them now as younger folks. And it means the world to them to see these characters out there. And it's only going to be more the case as these characters get larger platforms. You know, Kamala's got a TV show coming to Disney Plus next year. And it does feel like a kind of responsibility to not screw it up too bad. So I'm still learning. I'm still learning. But it's a delightful book to write.
You've taken the opportunity to introduce the world to Dearborn's first superhero through Ms. Marvel, Fadi Fadlala, who's also known as Amulet. You want to tell us about this guy? We're going to be meeting him in March.
Yeah. So Fadi is a ex-football player from Dearborn, Michigan, who in his superhero life is the mystical defender Amulet. I knew as soon as Marvel called me a couple of years back that I would like to introduce an Arab American superhero to the company. And but that's a process. You first have to sort of build the trust and the sort of respect with the folks there that they're willing to kind of give you that shot. You have to kind of find the right niche for the character. A lot of pieces have to be in place. And so I'd been thinking for a couple of years now that I would like to introduce such a character, but who exactly he would be, exactly what his powers were, all of that sort of kind of built along the way. And so Fadi will debut in The Magnificent Ms. Marvel number 13, which is out in March, I believe March 4th. We're doing a big signing in Dearborn, Michigan. I'm really excited. And he's going to be Marvel's first Arab American, at least prominent first Arab American superhero. And he's going to be, we've already got a couple of other appearances lined up for him after that.
Oh, nice.
And and he's a kind of gentle giant type. He's a defensive tackle from Dearborn who quit football because he hurt somebody. And it was very important for me to show an Arab man and a Muslim man or young man who was kind. You know, we don't see a lot of that in our media. We see a lot of angry, fanatical guys with beards and not a lot else. And so I wanted to show that we could also be goofy, sweet, you know, big lugs. And so that's kind of who Fadi is. And we'll see more and more of him and learn more and more of his backstory. He's got a great grandma who's his sort of mentor in fighting monsters. And we've got a lot of fun stuff planned for the character.
Is he drawn from anybody you knew growing up?
More a type, more a generalization of a lot of guys I knew growing up more than any in one person. But it's pretty telling that as soon as we sort of started to talk about him and his origins online, one reader was literally like, he used to play defensive tackle for Fortson High School, didn't he? I was like, yeah, that's exactly the energy we are going for. You got it exactly right. So clearly people are seeing themselves and folks who look like them in this character already. Even kind of bigger guys who are not necessarily represented by the hyper-muscularized superhero body type are responding to the character. So it's been really wonderful, and he's not even on the page yet. So
yeah. You know, right now there's a pretty solid sphere of African-American work in pop culture and literature. Everything from Black Panther to all of the amazing other dramatic films that have come out in the recent couple of years. You could argue that the Asian American pop culture sphere has radically expanded in the past 10 years, from K-pop to, you know, seeing different films, you know, come out and get major distribution like The Farewell. I'm still wondering what constitutes the Arab American mass market pop culture sphere.
I think on one level, it's sort of apples and oranges in terms of kind of how even these communities define themselves. I think that the process of coming up with the very notion that there's such a thing as Arab Americans as a unified group has been a very different process than it has been for, say, Black Americans. So I don't know how much comparison we can do, but I definitely see my work and the work of other younger, especially Muslim Americans and Arab Americans out there creating as part of that general trend. I mean, I owe an enormous debt to black artists and black genre creators in particular for sort of paving a lot of way and putting up with a lot of stuff to pave that way. But it's encouraging, you know, despite all the sort of horror out there, it is encouraging seeing, especially, as I say, the younger creators out there. When I went to create Amulet, I knew that I wanted to have an Arab American artist be the person who designed him visually, because his design was based on the Nazar, which is a sort of symbol in throughout the Mediterranean, the Middle East, but it's particularly important in kind of Lebanese culture. And I wanted to have an Arab American artist. And there's an Arab American artist named Sarah Alfaghi, who's just stunning. I mean, she's like in her 20s. She's very young, and she's already doing amazing work in terms of, she's got a graphic novel coming out, and she's creating characters for Marvel. And so she's sort of just representative of the fact that, especially online, when I interact with the younger artists and younger writers, there's a whole cadre of folks coming up now who, in a couple of years, I think are really going to stun people with everything that they're producing.
Saladin, it's awesome talking to you. Thank you for making some time for us.
Thank you.
Detroit area writer Saladin Ahmed. If you'd like to check out his work, you can start with his Hugo Award-nominated novel, Throne of the Crescent Moon. You can also try his first series with Miles Morales, Straight Out of Brooklyn. It's in bound form. Or the Detroit-based supernatural period mystery Abbott, published by Boom Comics. And Ms. Marvel, issue number 13, featuring the debut of Amulet, will be on your local comic book shop shelves Wednesday, March 4th. Ahmed will be signing copies at Green Brain Comics in Dearborn that day. You can find a little bit more information at our website. As we mark Black History Month, we've been exploring Black art and Black artists in a number of ways and media. Today, we have a poem for you to hear. Esperanza Cintron is the author of three books of poetry, including Chocolate City Latina, What Keeps Me Sane, and Visions of a Post-Apocalyptic Sunrise. She's a native Detroiter, Puerto Rican descent, and she holds a doctorate in English literature and teaches college. Here she is talking about a beloved yearly festival that celebrates the diversity of the African diaspora.
The African World Festival is my favorite festival. It used to be on the riverfront, which was really great. But when they built the Second Wright Museum, they moved the African World Festival to the streets behind the museum. And it's usually very closely packed. Because it's very well attended. People come out, they bring their kids, and lots of vendors from all over Africa, from Ghana, Nigeria, like the Sudan and so forth, they bring their wares, as well as African Americans. They set up art booths and so forth. And this was just one hot day when I attended one of these festivals. It's usually at the end of August, and I just sort of like taking a photograph. Okay. This poem is called The African World Festival. Streets narrowed by white tents, vendors tight on both sides like a third world street market. Browsing brown folks stroll to the smell of incense, barbecue, and fish frying. Speakers creak and crackle beneath the strained falsetto of an R&B quartet dressed in shark skin and doing a Motown dip and strut across the grand stage. The lone keyboard resolute as the sun-struck band takes a break, guitars and drums idle. Drooping parents sit on folding chairs or curbs, feet splayed. Toddlers lick cones and sticky-fingered caramel corn from wax paper bags near booths packed with wooden sculptures from Mali, metal via Ghana, and vibrant bolts of cloth amid the musical voices of dark men bartering with smiles and straight white teeth as evening begins to tip in and the blessed air cools.
Detroit writer Esperanza Cintron reading a poem from her book, Visions of a Post-Apocalyptic Sunrise. That's our show for today. This episode of Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Peggy Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Producers are April Van Buren, Laura Weber-Davis, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.